Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
It's great to be here. I really am honored to get a chance to talk about this, an issue that's been near and dear to my heart. I want to just say at the outset one sort of apology. I know a lot of you already know a lot about this, and some of you are sort of looking at these issues for the first time. So some of what I tell you, you may already know, but I've tried to put this in a way that's helpful to those who are exploring it for the first time. The second thing is that this is a very confusing area because practices change so much, are so different from one jurisdiction, in fact, as I will talk about, from one county to another in various states. And the time at which bail is set is called different things in different places. First appearance hearings in some places, arraignment in some places, bail hearings in some places. But basically what I'm talking about is when the first decision is made to determine whether a person is going to be released, either on their personal promise to come back, personal recognizance, or on some sort of money bond. And pretrial detention is the first time where we really see, although we'll see it all the way through the criminal justice system, sort of the justice of rich and poor. You can imagine, or maybe some of you experienced this, I won't ask for a show of hands, but you're stopped by law enforcement officers late one night, you're taken into custody, and you go to the local jail, where you will find yourself among people, strangers in various states of sobriety and lucidity, some of whom are suffering from infectious diseases like tuberculosis or the flu or anything else you can imagine. Some have mental illnesses such as schizophrenia. Some don't look that friendly. People are throwing up and going through all sorts of agony of withdrawing from drugs and alcohol. The guards are ordering people around using more expletives than any other words. There's absolutely no privacy. There are no bathrooms. I mean, if you're going to have a bowel movement, it's going to be in front of everybody in this big room full of people. And what do you want at that time? You want out, right? I mean, you want out, and you want a lawyer. And if you can afford it, or perhaps more correctly, in many cases, if your parents can afford it, you will get a lawyer within moments of letting them know that you're in the jail, and they will have you out probably that afternoon, either by going to a bondsman and posting bond or getting before a judicial officer and having you released. But the overwhelming majority of people in the criminal justice system, 90% are poor. They can't afford a lawyer. And so they're totally dependent upon the system to provide them with one. Usually, they don't have anybody to secure a bond for them, and the bond is probably out of their price range even so, and no one to advocate for their release. Now, I want to start with sort of the top of the programs that exist in a minority of jurisdictions, such as the five boroughs in New York and Washington, D.C., a person will have a pretrial services agency interview them, determine what their ties are to the community. They will meet a lawyer and actually have an interview before they come to court, and then they'll go to court for this bail hearing, and the lawyer will advocate for their release. John Wool has just succeeded 2 weeks ago after many months and years of trying to get a pretrial release system set up here in New Orleans. Never been one before. Everybody get arrested and then wait 2 months before they had their next hearing. But far more common is a person who doesn't see a lawyer for months or weeks after arrest and usually is in jail during that time. No one argues for bond. No one checks to see what their community ties are. No investigation is being made of the charges that they're facing, or even to be in a position to make an intelligent offer about whether to resolve the case with a plea bargain. 96% of all criminal cases are resolved with a plea bargain. They're not trying hardly any cases. But the question is it an informed plea bargain once the time comes? And so you have situations like this. We've done a lot of work on indigent defense in Georgia, and we had one of the people working for us was a student from Dartmouth, an intern, who went down to the Crisp County Jail in Cordele, Georgia, and was interviewing some people there, and they said, you really should talk to this fellow Samuel Moore. And so she went and she talked to Samuel Moore. He had been arrested 13 months earlier, a year and a month earlier, on the high crime of loitering. which is standing around while black. You've heard of driving while black. Well, loitering is standing around while black. You're just standing somewhere and the police decide to arrest you. In 13 months, he had not seen a judge. He had not seen a lawyer. And when Atiyah went to the clerk's office to find out what was holding him, she found that the charges had been dismissed 4 months earlier. But nobody had bothered to tell the jail. And so this Dartmouth intern asked the clerk's office, will you please call the jail and tell them there's no legal basis for having this man in jail? And he was released. We found other people in the jail who had been there 7 months and lesser periods of time, but Mr. Moore was the longest we had. But it is not unusual in places for people to get lost in jail. The consequences of pretrial detention, not being out, not being with your family, not keeping your job, are immense. But I'll give you one particularly sad example. Jacqueline Winbrone, who was arrested near Syracuse and charged with possession of a firearm found in the family car. She didn't have a lawyer to argue for bond. She had bond set fairly high on a bond schedule. She was certainly an excellent candidate for release on her personal promise to come back. She had no criminal record. She had a family right there. She was local. All of that. And she was the sole caretaker of her husband, who had to be taken to dialysis a couple of times a week. She desperately tried to get out, but she could not get a lawyer. She couldn't get anyone to pay attention to her case. At one point, finally, her husband died because he had not been taken to dialysis. Now she wants to get out just to go to his funeral. But she still has no way, no advocate, nobody to try to get her bond reduced so she can go to, so she misses her husband's, not only does he die, she misses his funeral. But 2 months later, she still hadn't seen a public defender or a court-appointed lawyer, but a lawyer from a prisoner rights organization takes pity upon her, goes to the court, files a bond motion, she gets out on her personal promise to come back. That could have been done the first day after her arrest. Instead, it's months after her arrest. And then a short time later, the charges are dismissed. So she's not convicted of anything. But you can see how she has been punished rather severely by the process which she went through. On sort of a more typical kind of case, Chris Phillips was a schizophrenic man, but holding his life together fairly well with medication, working as a clerk at a store and living in a small duplex in Atlanta. And he was arrested, Chris was arrested on a five-year-old warrant for criminal trespass. He only spent 2 weeks in jail before the charges were dismissed and he was released. But during those 2 weeks, he lost his job. When he went home, all his stuff was out on the front yard. He had been evicted because he hadn't paid his rent. And so here's this schizophrenic man, barely living on the margins of society, and now he's homeless. And living on the streets and in the parks in Atlanta. This is happening, I want to emphasize, in the state courts more than anywhere else, as are most things related to the criminal justice system. We talk so much about federal courts. I always remind my students, the federal courts handle about 350,000 cases a year, and of those, about 78,000 are criminal cases. The state courts handle 48 million cases a year. So that's where the action is, particularly when it comes to criminal justice. Of the 3.2 million, we have the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world. 3.2 million people, men, women, and children in prison. Only 200,000 of those are federal. All the rest come from the state systems. So what I'm talking about here is the different state courts. And within a state, there are all kinds of different courts. There may be one court that handles felony matters, another court that handles misdemeanors. Those courts may, in some states, also handle the first appearance hearings for felony cases. There are all sorts of different things there. Of course, there's a juvenile court that deals with children. There may be a county court that deals with, or that may be the lower version of the state court. And then every municipality has a court. From Atlanta, the biggest, to Palmetto, the smallest. These municipal courts are really cash cows for the cities, the municipalities. Basically, they deal with traffic tickets. running a little short on money, just go out to the interstate with your radar gun, pull over a few people, and you'll get $200 a person. And that basically is how that works. So there are a lot of courts, and they operate, but those courts have the power to detain and do detain people for various reasons. But when a person is arrested, if all goes well, they should appear before a magistrate or a judge within a day or two of arrest. But all that happens in a lot of these places, where there is no pretrial services agency, and that's the vast majority of places, no lawyer assigned to the person, is that the magistrate or the judge simply advises the person of their rights, which they've already been advised of by the police, determines whether there's probable cause for arrest, which the Supreme Court has said if the person's held, there has to be probable cause. That can be done just by looking at the police report, as long as it's notarized, and saying, based upon this report, I find probable cause to hold this person, and sets bond, which is usually pursuant to some sort of schedule. In some jurisdictions, they will also question the defendant about whether he or she is indigent, whether they're eligible for a court-appointed lawyer. And in some places, you don't get a court-appointed lawyer until after that decision has been made by the magistrate. So, of course, you don't have one at that hearing, that critical hearing, which is going to decide, do you get out that day and keep your job and keep your home and your car and all those things, or do you stay in jail for the next several months? The Supreme Court has never required, so far, that there be a lawyer at this first appearance hearing. There may be no prosecutor either. There may be a police officer or someone like that. And the bail decision is often made with absolutely no information about the person who's before the court, whether that person lives in the community, whether they own property, whether they have family, and whether they have a steady job. There's no lawyer, no pretrial services agency to tell them. There's nobody to bring people to court. Because sometimes you can bring mother to court and you can say to the judge, mother here will make sure that he comes back for every court appearance, and the person is released into the third-party custody of their mother or whoever it might be. In my view, lawyers are critical in this process. When I practiced law in D.C., and Truman Morrison is here, and we'll talk more about how pretrial services works in Washington, D.C., but when I got a new case, I would get the report of the D.C. Pretrial Services Agency. I would have an opportunity to interview my client. I would have enough time to verify much of the information that he or she gave me, and often get people down to court from the family, because that afternoon we would go before a judge and we would have a bond hearing. And I will tell you that both having the information on the pretrial services report as well as having a lawyer to say what the community ties are and why this person ought to be released is critical if people are going to be intelligently dealt with at the bail hearings. But as I said, most places, that's not the case. Kevin Walker, arrested last November in Harris County, Georgia, charged with some drug offenses. Next day, he was taken to a room. This is very popular for these kind of hearings. It was video conferencing. The judge can't bring the people to the courthouse, that's too much trouble. Can't bring the judges to the jail, that's too much trouble. So the judge is at the courthouse, and the defendant is taken in a little room, and there's a little TV screen, and if you look real quick, you can see sort of the judge up there, and the judge can sort of see the defendant back there. The judge asked him, did he want an attorney? He said yes. And all the judge said was, well, you're denied bond. So even though he told the judge that he wanted a lawyer, nothing happened. He didn't get any application form to ask for a public defender. He told the guards and the administrative people of the jail he wanted a public defender, and he wanted an application. You've got to apply for a public defender. Finally, somebody told him that there was a guy named John Wilson in the public defender office who was his lawyer. But he'd never seen Mr. Walker. He had never been brought to the courthouse and never appeared before a judge, except for that little TV interview that he had at the start. The flip side of this is here in New Orleans. I was talking to somebody yesterday about their experience. The defendant makes a $10,000 bond, which means you put 10% down to a bondsman usually, and in some courts you can put 10% down in the court. The judge says, and this is common throughout the country, if you can make bond, you're not indigent. You don't get a court-appointed lawyer. Of course, your family scraping up everything it has to pay the 10% to get you bond probably leaves everybody destitute. And lawyers are expensive. You're talking, even for a misdemeanor case, $5,000 to $10,000 to get a lawyer. This particular person, the judge says, you're not entitled to a lawyer, I'm not going to give you one. Go get a lawyer, be back in 2 weeks. Person goes out, tries to find a lawyer, of course can't. Comes back, judge says, find a lawyer, 2 weeks. This happens 4 times, 2 week intervals. And on the 4th time, the defendant comes back again and says, I'm not able to afford a lawyer. And the judge says, well, you know, now that I think about it, I'm raising your bond to $50,000. Sheriff, take him into custody. So now, because this person couldn't find a lawyer, he's detained prior to trial. And again, as I said, I mean, this is sort of uniquely New Orleans, where everything is unique. That just shows, and as I said, the practices differ so much from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and even from one jurisdiction to another within a state. Texas has a law that says that a person says that the court shall appoint counsel as soon as possible, but not later than the end of the 3rd working day after the date on which the court receives the request for counsel. So it puts the burden on the indigent defendant, who probably doesn't know that he has this right to make this request. But even when they do, Diego Morin was arrested in Del Rio, Texas, charged with capital murder. He asked for a lawyer the day after he was arrested. I need a lawyer, facing the death penalty in Texas, where you usually get the death penalty. 8 months go by before he is appointed a lawyer, even with this statute on the books. I'll talk in a minute about just what happens when you have a case like this and the lawyer is not on the case from the start. And 8 months later, some lawyer's given a case after the prosecution has spent all this time building their case, quite apart from any bail decision. In Louisiana, this, John may change this, but in a lot of courts, you don't get a lawyer until this indigency determination has been made by the judge. And as I said earlier, that means you don't have a lawyer when the bail decision is made. In Colorado has one of the most interesting laws. One of my students told me about this law, and I said, no, that couldn't possibly be the law. Well, it is. In Colorado, in a misdemeanor case, the defendant must talk to the district attorney before he or she can be appointed a lawyer. That's statutory. I told the Colorado defenders when I was out there, I thought there were some serious problems with this, and I didn't quite understand why they hadn't challenged it. North Carolina has a much better system. It says that a person arrested has got to be advised within 72 hours of the opportunity. It's not like Texas, which leaves it to the defendant to know. This says the judge has to inform the person that they can apply for indigency and counsel within 72 hours. Lawyers are critical, in my view, in this question of pretrial detention. Poor people, like people who can afford lawyers, should be dealing with the police and the prosecution and the courts through lawyers. Bernie Madoff had a lawyer to deal with the prosecution, the police, and the court. Didn't do him a lot of good, but he had one. But for a lot of people, it does make a huge difference. A lawyer can investigate, as I said earlier, the community ties that the person has, make the case for release on personal recognizance or bail. Often the lawyer will contact, as I alluded to earlier, the family and friends of the person and get those people down to show the judge, here's the support this person has in the community, this is why this person can be released, these people will vouch for the person. A lawyer who defends poor people accused of crimes should be trained in recognizing mental illness. Jails are our largest mental institutions in every community where there is one. The 3 largest inpatient psychiatric facilities in this country are the Los Angeles County Jail, Rikers Island Jail in New York, and the Cook County Jail in Chicago. It's estimated, and I think this is a low estimate, that 350,000 mentally ill people are in our jails and prison. And a lawyer who has a mentally ill client will be able to do something immediately rather than months later to deal with issues such as the client not getting medication. A lot of people that are mentally ill are taking off their medication when they come to jail, and they decompensate pretty quickly. If you have a lawyer advocating for you, you may be able to stay on your psychotropic drugs. The lawyer can start looking at, is this person even competent for trial? Does he or she have a sufficient understanding of what's going on that they can relate to their lawyer, that they can participate in this? Lawyer may recognize intellectual disabilities, mental retardation of clients. Many clients, you have to do a little work before you find out they've learned to sort of mask their mental retardation, and you find out ways to get beyond that, and you investigate a little bit and find out. Or the client may be a child. I mean, we're charging as adults. People 12, 13, 14 years old are being charged in adult court. In fact, I was talking to somebody the other day about a kid who at age 14 was sentenced and put in the prison system, and to protect him, he was put in solitary confinement for 8 years. You can imagine what that did to him at that age. But usually what that means when you have a client who's mentally retarded or a child is that that person is very vulnerable. Brian Stevens and I were talking the other day, and he told me about going to see a client at the jail in Montgomery, Alabama. And when he got there, the client just wouldn't talk to him. And he kept trying and trying and trying. The client wouldn't talk to him. And finally, Brian just sort of pulled his chair around, and he sort of put his arm around this kid, and he said, look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. And the kid said, well, the first night I was brought here, I was raped. The second night, I was raped by 5 people. Last night, I was raped by so many people that I can't tell you how many people raped me. Now, that happens all the time. Not all the time, but it happens at a very high rate in our jails and in our prisons. And a lawyer who knows that the client is vulnerable can often do things. I was actually called by juvenile justice one time and said, we've got this kid with an IQ of 45 going into the adult system. IQ of 45. And 16 years old. So addiction is another problem. Many of our clients, most clients, have addiction. But I found that getting my clients out was the most important. This was in the 1970s. All these things I'm talking about are going on right now. Even back then, which was a long time ago, if we could get people out, I felt like the most important thing I did was get my clients out at the first appearance hearing, at the bail hearing. Because if I did, it'd mean the client could, if they had a job, continue it. They could stay with their family. They could work with me on the case while we were investigating it and figuring out what to do about it. And I found this. I found that my clients, and Truman Morrison, who was a trial chief at the time, taught us that you've got a much better chance that if you walk into sentencing with your client free, there's a much better chance you're going to walk out than if the client is brought in by the marshals from the lockup. Because if the person's been in the community, if they've had a job, if they've done whatever they're supposed to do, of course it works both ways, if they haven't done what they're supposed to do, that's going to be a problem. But if they have, there's going to be much more likelihood the judge is going to put the person on probation than if the person comes, as I said, out of the lockup. A rapid response by the lawyer can often result in the charges being dismissed within a day or two. You can do a little checking on something, you can find out, wait a minute, if you knew this, you would want to dismiss these charges. Because a lot of cases are dismissed. A lot of cases are dismissed prior to trial for one reason or another. But as I pointed out earlier, if you're held in jail for months or weeks or a year or whatever it is, it may be impossible. I mean, somebody, I remember a case I had where I talked to the kid the next day, last night, when the crime was supposed to take place, I was with these people. I go out and interview those people that day, last night, the very night before. They all knew what happened the night before. If I had talked to them 8 months later, the days all run together. Let's see, was that the night we were drinking beer? Well, we drank beer every night. Was that the night we were shooting at cans? People are not going to be able to remember. The days are going to run together. You've lost that evidence. It's gone. It's gone. Because the prosecution is going to be able to show that that person can't remember what happened on August 5th, 2011. Anybody know what they were doing on August 5th, 2011? So unless there's some sort of trigger there, often that's critical in terms of the investigation. As I said, Dago Morin in Texas denied a lawyer for 8 months after arrest. Tremendous disadvantage now. I mean, the trail is cold. The prosecution's had 8 months to build its case. Nothing's been done for him. And his lawyer is going to have to depend mostly on the state's investigation, try to do some more. But a lot has happened, and the person is very, very much at a disadvantage in that situation. But lawyers are often not good or do not try to get release. Jerry Griffin was charged in Crisp County, Georgia. This is again where Samuel Moore was. Met with a public defender for a few minutes right before a bond hearing. He was arrested in late November, bond hearing in the middle of December, and that was the last time he ever saw anybody from the public defender's office in court. In fact, that public defender office, that's about the only time you ever meet your lawyer is in court. They bring everybody over, plea day, and I watched them plead the other day. There were 10 people standing. Public defenders at one end of the line and the prosecutors at the other. They all plead together, group pleas, because we just got to process these people through the system. And the prosecution then afterwards, they took them one at a time for sentencing. The prosecution would ask for this sentence or that sentence, and all the public defender would do is say, and Your Honor, don't forget to add on the $50 public defender fee. You know, if you're one of these guys standing in line, like, oh, who's on my side here? You know, this person's asking that I be fine. This person's asking that I be fine. Where's my advocate in all this? But that's another point that I want to make, which is pretrial detention is used to coerce pleas, often uncounseled pleas. In Houston, there was a nice piece about this in terms of reporting on this in the Houston Chronicle. About every day, there are 15 criminal courts in Houston. 6 to 10 men, all shackled together. I say, when I practice, going to a lot of the courts I go into, it looks like a slave ship is docked outside the courthouse because all these black men in orange jumpsuits, all handcuffed together, brought in, put in the jury box, the first couple of rows. And they're all brought there to plead guilty for time served. They call this different things in different places. Jail clearing day in Atlanta every Thursday. Everybody in jail after a certain amount of time is brought up to court, told if you plead guilty today, you'll get out. In Michigan, they call it Mac Justice Day when this happens. And the word goes out, if you go to court and plead guilty, you're going to get out. If you want a trial, you'll probably spend 6 months to a year in jail before you get your trial. And so they're hauled into court. And plead guilty. In Houston, almost everybody is held pretrial. Only about 7% get out. What they don't know, in Florida, I wanted to mention this, in Florida, 500,000 misdemeanors processed every year in Florida. A study done there recently said that many of the cases are disposed of in 3 minutes or less. It's 3 minutes of court time to resolve the case. Two-thirds of the cases, the person does not have a lawyer. The person just pleads guilty and gets out or gets whatever they're going to get. Now, in a lot of jurisdictions that I practice in, the effort to sort of balance the books on the shoulders of the poor is remarkable. The judge will make no inquiry into whether this person who's pleading just to get out has any ability to pay a fine. They probably don't because they've been in jail now for 5 months or whatever it's been. But instead, will impose a fine. Now, here again, the justice of rich and poor. If you're a wealthy person or a person of means and you get fined $1,000, you pay it and you're out of there. The system's over for you. If you're poor, you don't have $1,000. But the kindly judge will tell you, we'll let you pay in installments. You can pay so much a month for 12 months. What he doesn't tell them is that a private probation company, one of the many private agencies, lining their pockets at the misery of the poor, will collect their check every month for $40. So not only are they going to pay the installments, but they're going to pay $40 on top of that to this private probation company. Inevitably, they'll get behind, and then they'll go back to jail until they can pay or their family can come up. These are today's debtors' prisons, which is not the subject I'm supposed to be talking about, but it's something worth knowing. People who can't pay their child support, people who can't pay their fines, who get locked up. The Supreme Court said in three cases, you've got to make a determination of whether it was willful, whether it was a willful failure to pay. If the person has no ability, if the person is completely destitute, like a lot of my clients, I got a young woman right now living in her car, and she's about to lose the car. So she's homeless, going to be homeless, and probably is homeless right now if you call living in your car a home. But at any rate, that is often what happens. Unnecessary pretrial detention is extremely expensive. For local governments, you've got to keep these people in jail. It costs money, but it puts those accused of a crime at a tremendous disadvantage in defending their cases. It keeps the homeless and the mentally ill out of sight. And, of course, we have the quality of life crimes in a city like Atlanta, New York. You can be arrested for loitering, for blocking the sidewalk, for jaywalking, all these different kinds of crimes. It doesn't mean police can lock up anybody they want to. The judges in Atlanta, there's a park right outside the building where the judges had their chambers, and the judges were looking down this park, and there are all these poor people out there in the park. You know, you got to be somewhere, and the park is a pretty good place to be. So one of the judges called the police and said, get these people out of the park. So the police came and arrested them all and took them to the Fulton County Jail. It's not the most compassionate court in the country, quite obviously. That is certainly one of the purposes of holding people pretrial is to get them out of sight. For the Olympics in Atlanta, I mean, everybody got arrested. It coerces guilty pleas, a major... And even people are innocent. I mean, you're innocent, but, you know, what do you want to do? And of course, often there's no knowledge of the collateral consequences. There's no knowledge that because you're pleading guilty, you may, you know, you'll not be eligible for food stamps. You can't live in public housing. You'll be deported if you're here, if you're undocumented. All of these things, which, of course, when people plead by themselves, they have no idea. And when they plead with lawyers and only talk to them for a minute or two, they have no idea either. All of these reasons, illegitimate reasons for keeping people in jail before trial. But it is another reminder, in my view, that the courts are the institution least affected by the civil rights movement. This comes down very heavily, of course, on the poor and on African Americans particularly, but all minorities. And it is also an everyday example, which you find all the way through the criminal justice system, of how lawless this system is and how every day we violate what's supposed to be the most fundamental promise of the Constitution, equal justice under law. So we have etched above the Supreme Court. I keep saying, if we don't do better than this, we're going to have to sandblast equal justice under law off the Supreme Court building because we are failing so miserably in every way in that regard. In our criminal justice system today, it's better to be rich and guilty than to be poor and innocent, and that's obviously not equal justice. And the way in which people are handled from the very start, from their pretrial determination of whether they're going to be released or whether they're going to stay in jail, is one of the most critical places, and I hope that you will bring that to the attention of the American people. Thank you very much.
Sure. So we'll have some time for about 10 or 15 minutes of questions. I'm sure you've got them. An excellent, rich source of, I think about 10 stories I heard out of that. So if you have a question, please just stand up, tell us who you are.
I have a question. My name is Dennis Bartlett. I'm from the commercial bail industry. Pretrial detention appears to be affected like the criminal justice system, as you describe it, sounds like a Rubik's Cube that's out of kilter. You push one thing, something else goes wrong. It appears to me that the pretrial detention process is just as disaffected as any other component of DAs, the jails, the correction system, the police, and so forth. So it doesn't seem to me that the problem is directly linked to the pretrial system. It's the whole thing that's gone wrong.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I was only asked to talk about pretrial detention, but I'd be happy to tell you all the other problems of the criminal justice system. But I will say this. I think one reason that this happens is mass incarceration. In the 1970s, we had about 200,000 people in prison and jail in this country. Now it's 2.3 million. The courts have not grown that much. Prosecutors' offices have grown. They always give money to the prosecutors. The federal government gives all these grants to police and prosecutors and crime labs and all that. But they don't give any money to the defense. And so you have public defender offices, which have always been underfunded, where you have them. Now, there are a lot of states that don't have them. Alabama, there are only two public defender offices, one in Tuscaloosa and one in Shelby County. And that's it. The rest of it is just court-appointed hacks who get these cases. And, of course, the only way you can make money on court-appointed cases is to handle as many cases as possible in as little time as possible. One lawyer, a contract, they low bid. A lot of counties in California award their indigent defense to contractors, low bid contractors. You can imagine if you get the lowest bid to represent people, that's not too good. One of the lawyers testified under oath that he disposed of 70% of his cases at the first appearance hearing after a 30-second conversation. That's not legal representation. There's nothing. There's no client interview. There's no investigation. There's no review of the prosecution's case. I mean, there's absolutely no legal representation taking place. And the same thing with all these meet 'em and plead 'ems when it comes time to clear the jail. There's no legal representation. I can teach high school kids to tell people what the plea is and let them put down a plea. Yes?
So is this the
result?
So is this the responsibility of the public defender's office? I mean, is it just that the public defender's office is not getting enough funding to represent people?
I think usually it's not. I think it's usually a systemic problem with the court system and how it's set up. Because very often, as I said, some places, public defender doesn't get appointed. The terminology is different in different places. But if you call the first appearance hearing, in other words, a guy gets arrested within 24 or 48 hours, they go before some judicial officer, usually at the jail or on TV, something like that, bond set. And there's no lawyer there. There's no requirement that a lawyer be there. Maryland recently, the court said you had to have lawyers at those hearings, and the public defender threw a fit, said we can't possibly staff these. We can't staff it. We can't do it. And then their next hearing will be what I would call the arraignment, where they enter a not guilty plea. And that may be, you know, months later. And, of course, they're locked up that whole time. And, of course, as I said, a lot of places don't have public defenders. I think one of the things about it, one of the reasons we fought very hard in Georgia to get a public defender started was so that, like if you're in Perry, Georgia, Houston County, Georgia, had a public defender for a long time, they check the jail every day. And if there's a new person at the jail, they interview them, they get them before a judge, and they try to get them out. So that can be a solution. But I would not put this as much on the public defenders as I would put it on the court system for the way in which they have the hearings. I mean, one of the things, and John and I were talking about this, whether you have access to your client before the hearings. Because here in New Orleans, there's very, very little time for the pretrial services agency that just got started 2 weeks ago to interview people. And the lawyers are not interviewing them during that time. Yes?
Andy Wilson from the Courier Journal.
Yeah, how are you, Andy? Good to see you.
Could you tell us how federal court compares and contrasts with what you described?
Well, the federal courts, I would say, are the boutiques of the legal business. You know, you have magistrates, you have federal public defenders, you have a CJA, a Criminal Justice Act list of lawyers. In my experience, at least, and, you know, again, things may be different in different places. Not every federal district has a public defender, but almost all of them do. And generally, it's much more like what I described about the D.C. process, that the person is going to go before a magistrate, they're going to be represented by a public defender, and that public defender is going to represent them, you know, throughout their case. Public defenders handle so few cases in federal court. I mean, Stephanie Kearns was telling me in her office a lawyer may close less than 100 cases in a year. The public defender in Louisville Dan told me, I believe, that they close something like, one lawyer, 1,700 cases in a year. So that's a huge difference in terms of how much time you can have. Yes,
so
ma'am?
Is the detention law itself, is that stacked for the government, or what's the...
I think, you know, I don't practice in this area in federal court, but I think it's a presumption that if they're the ties and so forth of release, and that there are more people released as a result of it, particularly on petty charges. I mean, the problem in state courts is there's so many of these petty charges, these misdemeanors, that is crimes punished by a year or less, or here in Louisiana, 6 months or less. There's just a huge volume of those people because the police are arresting all these people on spitting on the sidewalk and things like that. You don't get those kind of cases in federal court. I mean, you just don't have the volume of cases. And if you don't have the volume, then you can deal with the cases differently, you know. Yes, ma'am.
Mary Ann Spoto from the Star Ledger. I have a two-part question. Are there many state courts that deny bail for serious offenses? And if your state is going to that system, and it's pretty much a done deal politically, what are the safeguards that can be put into that to help protect the defendant's rights?
Tell me just a little more. I'm sorry. I don't want to be
New
sure
Jersey,
I answer your question.
New Jersey is right. Going to, there's this move afoot to deny bail, to give judges the discretion to deny bail for more serious offenses like drugs and murder and stuff like that. So I'm trying to see how New Jersey compares to other states. Are there other states that have a system like that now? And it seems like it's almost a done deal politically. So I'm trying to see.
What did they do before, if I may ask?
They had a bail system, and they would set it high, so the defendants couldn't get out anyway.
Right. And so, you're just saying now they're going to a system where they just simply deny bail completely?
Correct.
I don't quite see what the point is.
To vote on for an amendment. Constitutional amendments. It's Senate.
Right. They have to do a constitutional amendment.
Right.
They have to do that.
So they'll vote November.
I think that'll if you have capital cases, you can hold a person without bail. The theory being, you're facing the death penalty. You've got a very strong incentive to flee. In other cases, I mean, the Eighth Amendment says you can't have excessive bail if you have no bail at all. For certain kinds of cases, I would think they're going to run into some problems.
The argument that our governor makes, who's pushing this, says the federal system does it. He's a former U.S. attorney. His argument is they do this in the federal system now, and it doesn't clash with the federal constitution. So he doesn't see a problem doing it in New Jersey, and he's not getting much.
Oh, yeah, and you know, that reminds me. When I was in D.C., this is in the 70s, so experimented in D.C., and Truman may remember this better than I do, but this was when they first started having, what do they call it, Truman, where you were locked up?
Yeah. Preventive detention.
Preventive detention, yeah. And it was seen as something that rarely happened, that you had a long hearing and made sure that there was more than probable cause and the person was dangerous and all these things. And then they could be held, but they had to be tried within 2 months, as I recall. I may be wrong. It may have been 3 months, but very prompt trials. Now, that kind of pretrial detention is everywhere for every... It just shows, once you start doing things like this, it just spreads like kudzu all through the system. Because I'm just amazed when I talk to public defenders now. And I suppose if those safeguards are in there, that has been upheld. So depending upon how the law is written and so forth, they may be able to do it. I mean, that's probably what it is some sort of pretrial detention
law. May I speak to that? Because I'm a boutique judge. I'm a federal judge in
Cleveland,
Ohio.
Oh, good. Tell us your name.
James Carr. I'll be speaking in the next hour or so, in the next session. In the federal system, it's not a blanket prohibition. Preventive detention, it's not a blanket prohibition. However, preventive detention is part of our system because it shifts the burden of proof. There's a presumption for most crimes of release in favor of detaining. However, certain designated crimes, capital crimes, terrorism, certain big ticket drug cases, mandatory cases involve mandatory minimums of 10 years or so, there's a presumption of danger to the community or failure to appear. And therefore, the burden upon security, the burden of proving that you can, will show up, won't be a danger, shifts to the defendant. Now, it's not a blanket prohibition. I mean, that's what the Governor Christie is saying. He's not telling the full plain and unvarnished truth.
And of course, what most courts do in the state systems, which I'm more familiar with, is they just set the bond so high that the person can never make it. You set a $500,000 bond, and you know these folks don't have the money to do it. You set a $10,000 bond. Well, now you only got to pay 10% of that. You may be able to make it, but on these serious cases, generally judges set very, very high bonds. Theoretically, pretrial release is only about, the decision is only about whether the person will come back to court. But there's no question that the crime is taken into account. And if you have, you know, if you have joyriding in a car, you're much more likely to give that person personal recognizance or whatever than if you have murder of three people, obviously, or rape or some other very, very serious crime. Yes?
We've got a comment here. And then we have a question over there.
I'll skip my thing. I'm going to be on the next panel. So
okay. You sir, tell us your name is, and then we have our
guild. I'm Tom Gogola with The Lens here in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And my question has to do with the whether or not there is this sort of body of case law that is developing that's going to bring this whole pretrial detention problem through the courts. Where are the lawsuits? Where is this in the federal court appeals or the Supreme Court? Have there been constitutional challenges brought on these basic constitutional issues? And where is this country in regard to that? I mean, where are we on that trajectory towards having this problem adjudicated at a national level instead of these piecemeal injunctions and we'll go here and put in a system here? Where's the national focus on this?
Well, the closest the Supreme Court has come is in a case called Rothgary versus Gillespie County, I believe, Texas. And this was a fellow who was denied bail and a lawyer and so forth. And he finally did get out, but then the charges were dismissed, and it turned out all you had to do was check. I mean, it could have been dismissed right at the start if he had had a lawyer. So he filed a civil suit. And the court talks about when you're entitled to a lawyer. And they say, you know, within a reasonable time after the adversary process starts, and it's sort of, and then Alito writes a concurring opinion that sort of backs off that and says, well, really, you're only entitled to a lawyer like when you're actually, you know, in, you know, like at arraignment or something like that, when you announce your whether you're pleading guilty or not. So I'm not sure where the court ultimately would go with that. I mean, the Maryland court on its own law decided that people were entitled to lawyers there. And Doug Colbert, a good source on this, is Douglas Colbert, who teaches at the Maryland Law School in Baltimore. I mean, he actually did an experiment with his students to show that if you have representation at pretrial hearings, far more people will be released. And I had him actually testify an expert witness in a case I had where we were talking about jail overcrowding. And we were saying if you provided lawyers with people at the first appearance hearings, then more people would be released, and therefore the jail wouldn't be so crowded. And actually they did that, and that turned out to be true. Until then, the system had been everybody stayed in jail 3 months, no matter whether it was fair jumping or simple assault, and at the end of 3 months you were brought up and you pled guilty for time served. It was sort of Alice in Wonderland justice. But now, thanks to the lawsuit, you get a lawyer the day after you're arrested. It makes a huge difference.
And just for our point, there's not a consistent set of federal guidelines, like with the Miranda
right.
warning, for example.
Right.
Why?
Well, the court has said there have to be these probable cause hearings, but they say you don't have to have a lawyer at the problem. They can be very informal. They can be based on just a warrant. They have to be within a certain period of time. But there's no requirement that there be a lawyer there. In fact, in some places, it's as simple as the so-called magistrate just goes from jail cell to jail cell and does these hearings. They're not on the record. There's really no record of it except a little note made that bail is set at, you know, $10,000.
Gil, you have time for one more question, sir.
I'm Gil Halstead from Wisconsin Public Radio. Is there any way that technology could play a role in this? If we could put bracelets on more people so they wouldn't be sitting in those bullpens and would have to come back? And is that happening anywhere?
And we have, in Atlanta, where my life has been spent litigating against the Fulton County Jail, we've been trying to say, you know, you can either pay $70 a day to keep somebody locked up, or you can pay $12 for an ankle bracelet. Sure. I mean, and there are judges who, Charlie Baird was telling me, a judge in Austin, Texas, says, you know, he uses his GPS and whatever, say, you can't, if it's a domestic violence case, you can't come into this part of town. And if you do, they'll know about it. I've got a client right now who is on parole, and he wore one, and the rule was that he could leave his house at 4 in the morning to go to work. He works on construction. He actually left at 5 till 4, and they called him and told him he had violated because he had left 5 minutes early. You know, they had to wait till 4 before he could leave. I mean, but it was that precise. So you can track people, and I think this technology is, there are a lot of people who have an economic interest in not having those things, obviously, but usually these private probation companies are the same companies that rent out the ankle bracelets for $12 and do all these other things. But that's clearly an answer here. Yeah.
I think Mr. Brown will be available during the break, I hope, for additional questions. But in the meantime, join me in thanking him. I want to bring up our next group of panelists and our moderator, Laura.